I'm Lisa Held, a food journalist and podcast host presenting Behind the Label with American Humane. Produced by Heritage Radio Network for Springer Mountain Farms, this podcast series dives into what the American Humane Certified Label really means. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's September, and as the days get shorter and temperatures cooler, it's time to go back to school. This week on Meat and Three, we're looking at how lunchtime is changing from elementary schools through college, whether classes are remote or in person.
While there was some information about where families could access food, it was spread out on many different websites.
I'm seeing people, advocate for going back into school. And a main reason is, food insecurity. Kids go to school and they get fed. And that's a whole other thing of fight for kids to be fed versus going to school.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Krista Scruggs. We'll talk to Krista about the world we live in, Zaffa Wines, co-sellers, and more. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Born and raised in California, Krista Scruggs eventually made her way east to Vermont. Along the way, she worked on her grandfather's farm, took a job with a big wine company, worked harvests in Europe, and cut her teeth at La Garagista. Krista is a true vigneron. She is co-owner of Zaffa Wines and co-wine sellers in Vermont. She is at the forefront of the new American wine revival, working with hybrid grapes, apples, other fruits, co-fermentations, and a commitment to sustainable, regenerative farming, along with low-intervention winemaking. You gotta love someone whose slogan is, just fucking fermented juice. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Krista.
Thank you for having me, Sam. I just chuckled at my slogan.
Yes. Even when you hear it, it sounds cool.
Yeah.
Due to the COVID-19 virus, we try to do interviews in the studio at the Heritage Studios at Roberta's. But now we're doing everything remote via Zencaster. So, Krista, just confirming, you're in Vermont right now, right?
I am. I'm in Isle Lamont.
Right.
Yeah.
Which Isle Lamont is a little island in Lake Champlain?
It's little. It's the most, and it's the most northern. And we're equidistant. I'm equidistant to Montreal as I am now to Burlington.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
So that is north.
Yeah.
So it's not right outside of Burlington. It's up a little.
Yeah, it takes about the car takes about an hour 10.
Wow.
from co-sellers, for example, if you leave from there.
One of my sons went to college up in Burlington, so we're very familiar with it.
UVM or Champlain?
Champlain.
Yeah.
All right, so I want everyone to know who you are. So I want you to give me a brief background on your journey in life and wine that got you to really where you are today, Isle Lamont, Vermont, owning Zaffa Wines and co-sellers. So give me a little run through on that.
Born and raised in the Central Valley of California, the farming belt of California. I literally grew up across the street from one of Gallo's tank farms.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't realize that until, it didn't hit me until actually I was in California earlier. It was last year that I was there visiting my grandmother. And I knew I grew up around, there's grapevines around, but I thought there were table grapes, I think, when I was a kid, not realizing right. that, it was Gallo. And that context became, I think it's the context of that is, falls on me. And the fact that, I eventually ended up working for Constellation Brands. While I was working for Constellation Brands, the tank farm location, production location in Madera. I was also living in Oakland, and it was the same around the same time that Ordinaire had opened. And I was working for Context and Brands while being a patron and tasting with the guys and gals at Ordinaire, not knowing that I was drinking a wine, you know, now referred to as natural wine, while also working for, you know, the largest conventional wine manufacturer in the one of the right. largest in the world. And so while I was working for Context and Brands, tasting, you know, tasting wines I was tasting at Ordinaire, I really didn't know that I was quote unquote tasting natural wine. I knew I was falling in love with wine in a different way that I was, for example, drinking it with my mother, grandmother, i.e. Robert Mondavi, growing up. That more or less, you know, being in the inside, working for Context and Brands, and then, you know, learning from wine on my own way, I decided to leave Context and Brands and I wanted to learn particularly how to grow. From people who were growing. And so that just led me on a journey, you know, learning how to prune in the state of Washington with a small grower there, and then bouncing around to Italy, a very profound experience in Cahors, and then to Texas. And then that led to a staging with Deirdre. All this, you know, when I left France,
Deirdre's Deirdre Heekin in Vermont, which is,
correct. Yeah,
you know, a big, important connection for you to Vermont.
A huge. I mean, I moved to Vermont solely after leaving France. I knew that, you know, I was doing the UC Davis Extension program at the same time too. And I knew that I wanted to grow. I knew that I financially didn't have the means or didn't feel it was going to be possible to do that in California. And three, I was looking specifically to stage with someone that could teach me what I wanted to learn, which is what I wanted to continue to learn, which was to farm with organic biodynamic practices and minimal intervention in the cellar. And in America, there's not many, at the time, there's still not many that fall within that umbrella, as opposed to those who make wine, quote unquote, conventionally. And Deirdre happened to be in California a couple of months after return from France. And I told her the long-winded story that I'm telling you right now, and asked her an opportunity to stage with her. And that, you know, the way the stars align and circumstances fell, that led into a job offer for me to go work out in Vermont with her and Caleb. And I was always with the contingency that I would, you know, eventually start my own label. And they always supported me
right.
procuring my own land. It just, you know, that was a 5-year plan. And here I am 4 years later and everything happened.
Yeah, but 4 years, you've been doing it a couple. So it was really a couple, and then a couple years later.
Exactly. Yeah. I did 1 year full on with her and Caleb and, you know, and them trusting me to apply already the knowledge I acquired up to that point. And a lot, you know, and I then that turned into my first vintage in 2017 that I released while still working with Deirdre. Or I debuted. It never really got far, but it got far enough that basically fast forward this journey quicker than I think we all expected it to move forward.
Right.
Yeah.
So you made wine while working with her at her facilities.
Correct. Yeah.
When you felt you were ready to, you know, give it your own shot, right?
Yeah, I felt just as ready as anyone would. I think right. it was more or less just to have the, you know, the vouching of her, you know, someone that I truly, you know, respect and admired and was learning from. And she felt that I, you know, had the chops to do it. I think that would give anyone some confidence.
Sure. So you're right in the middle of harvest right now. I mean, it's pretty much harvest in the United States. I mean, you must think I'm crazy for pulling you out of the fields, but you said yes.
I did say yes.
You did say yes. And I had to chase you down a little, but that was my pleasure. So this is your third vintage, second? As Zaffa?
17, third. 18, 19. No, this is technically be the fourth vintage.
Fourth.
Yeah, the first wine I actually made was not in Vermont. The first wine I made was in Texas.
Right.
And that ended up being Don Quixote, and that only saw New York. We ended up releasing it in mid 2018, but technically, but people don't realize that. Yeah, my first wine that I made was in Texas. Is that before I, you know, went out to do the staging with Deirdre, I had accepted an opportunity in Texas, and that was where, you know, how the story was supposed to go. And I just couldn't turn down an opportunity not to work with Deirdre. And then when that opportunity within itself, I treated Texas for, you know, up until this year as more or less my Southern Hemisphere. So I will go out to Texas, process, and then start going there in July. And then I will fly back here and then hop right into harvest here.
Right.
But since I just recently acquired my Zoffa's own land here in Vermont, that I couldn't do that this year.
Right. So we'll talk about that in length in a minute, but take me full circle here, because you also, you don't have to get into what it is, because again, we'll talk about it later, but when and how did co-sellers happen?
Co-sellers came about just me. It was right after I was managing a vineyard, after I left La Garagista to commit myself fully to Zoffa while still managing another vineyard. And I needed facility to produce in, and Shaxbury, who I was friends with, you know, we're all friends.
Shaxbury cider, legendary.
Right. Yeah. And we are all friends here. And I told him I was looking for, you know, space to at least to do alternate proprietorship. And then around that same time, a space opened in Burlington, presented as a co-making space for creatives. And nice. They asked if I wanted to team up with them. And then it was just going to be originally just Zoffa and Shaxbury sharing a space for their wild opera project, and then for Zoffa's full production. And then along the way, we created another brand, and decided to not only to share a space, but to produce together.
And that was a couple of years ago.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. And that's thriving in Burlington right now, right?
In Burlington, and people are receiving it well across the nine states too.
It's yeah. Nice. All right. So I want to go over a whole bunch of things with you. You were recently on the Today Show, which was really nice. You've been receiving, well, yeah, I mean, you've been, I want to get into that. You've been receiving a lot of great notices. You know, sometimes people look at you sort of as an overnight sensation, you know, because they didn't know about you or never heard of you doesn't mean you didn't exist or put the sweat in. Does that drive you crazy after everything you had to do to get here?
Yeah, you know, and then it does. And then it doesn't now, just as much as it did, you know, especially a couple years ago. I think now at this point in time, if my wines weren't holding up to, you know, if I hate the fucking word, but holding up to the word hype, then I think that I would have been weeded out. If I'm pretty transparent on my Instagram, you know, people know that I'm, you know, I'm putting in the work. I wouldn't be in, you know, to have someone like, for example, Jenny Lefcourt, you know, have me in her book. I think I have the vouch around me from the people who support me. And also I have to tell myself this, but I mean, you guys would have kicked me out a long time ago if it was just about me being overnight success, because you can't farm and make wine as an overnight quote unquote success. And I worked my ass up to this point. So I just can't, I have a vision and I'm so tunnel focused that I'm a human being and stuff. Of course, like that bothers me and drives me crazy. But then when I think about it, I'm like, I don't need to prove myself to anyone, because I think that I proved myself up to this point.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But people, you know, like I said, you just come on the scene now, and it had to be acceptance. You had to prove yourself. There had to be consistency, you know, all that's happening. And then when you have people like Jenny, you know, Lefcourt from Jenny and Francois, who has a legit portfolio.
Right.
You know, and takes you on and keeps you on and is a big advocate. That's a big deal. I never ask this question to my guests, but it's such crazy times. You know, with everything going on now, I mean, what are the things that are currently on your mind? I mean, things that you think about over and over. I know in normal circumstances, you know, whether it's harvest or business production or whatever, but there's just so many things going on. I mean, do things roll through your mind that sort of reoccur that are timely?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, I started on this journey 10 years ago. And I'm turning 36 and a month and some change.
You old.
I know, exactly.
No, you're not. No, you're not.
when I started on this journey was to something that just happened. You know, we planted 2,000 vines a little over a month ago. And, you know, I now everything that I worked for the last 10 years has came into fruition. And there's no important time there, you know, it's always been important time, but you know, the fact that, you know, in a time like this, that, you know, my team were like, we had lunch from the vegetables that we grew from, you know, one of the hoop culture beds for one of the vineyards we manage. And we're out in, you know, the back of, you know, the fallow land of this land foraging apples. And we, right. In a time like this, you know, California is literally on fire, which is where I'm, you know, that's my home state. And
right.
I'm here in Vermont and, you know, at the cost of being around, not being away from my family, all my dreams, all the hard work I put into is all, everything's working out, but it's at the cost of being away from, you know, people who stuck, you know, who my family. And, but I couldn't imagine any other time for me to say that I have my own land to farm and grow and to cultivate with people, because I don't think there's anything more political right now than to have suffrage in a place that you could call your own.
Yeah. Let's get a little deeper in that. Let's talk about our industry. From your perspective, you know, why is there still substantial racial and gender inequality and injustice in the food and wine system? I mean, it's been magnified, you know, lately, which is great. And there's been activism, which is great. But it's just not reflective of a level playing field. You know, what's your thoughts about that? I mean, are you, I don't want this to sound the wrong way, but are you away from it a little up in Vermont?
No, I'm a black queer woman in America. But
in Vermont, which may be the whitest state.
Exactly. Well, I mean, so I could change my winner's view in America, but I'm still a black queer woman in America. So that doesn't mean, except, I mean, the whitest state in the union, that, you know, presented as, you know, also the most liberal, which comes with its own
right.
issues, just like this industry.
But all your friends in New York,
huh?
You know, everyone in New York, you know, in the restaurant business, the wine business, there's this whole patriarchy and gatekeeping thing, you know, that still seems to exist. Yes. You agree?
It exists. Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I more or less don't, I have been able to just have navigated life. I don't need any of them. Gatekeepers. I'm, you know, and meaning I purposely try to position myself that I don't need you, and I don't need your support. I don't need you to your charity. I don't need your approval for me to do what mostly also, especially the work, you know, the work of my ancestors, aka farming.
Right.
And the industry is reflective of what the world is. And I think that the industry thought for some reason that they were above what this country is. And if anything, I feel what's been exposed, you know, this last year is that it's actually, it perpetuates it within this industry. And, you know, it was disgusting, you know, even in navigating this industry, like to navigate those things you listed, but, you know, to have people up in arms, literally, or people try to destroy the people's careers over fucking sulfur is,
right.
I think, the epitome of like, of this industry.
Yeah. I mean,
while there's people dying and there's people literally getting shot in the back, and that's the things that people still talk about. And I still think this industry is very performative and not done anything. There's a lot of silence. There's literally people who have removed themselves from Instagram, I think, to avoid either being called out or to avoid engaging.
Or looking, not looking the way,
yeah,
or
exactly.
being right. what it should be, you
exactly.
know,
because exactly.
it used to be so showy. Now I'm glad they ran away from that.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
do Do we think things are changing? Are they changing fast enough? Are they changing at all?
Time will tell. I mean, we're still, I mean, it's so raw right now. I mean, we're an election year, literally in a move of a civil rights movement and in the middle of a pandemic. I hope that, you know, by the time, you know, on the other side of this, which is maybe years, that there is some self-reflection from all of us. And what are we doing and why are we doing what we're doing? Mimi Castell just did a blog post, you know, released yesterday. And I think she's one of the only people who actually gets it.
Yeah. Well, you know, you should be all the talking, but I'll jump in and say that it kind of works from the inside out. And the way you've built your business addresses all these issues. And you'll explain, you know, I mean, what's important to you is diversity, you know, gender equality, how you treat your people. I mean, talk to me a little about how you structured your business and that if everybody took a little of that, you know, we'd certainly be on the right footing, right?
Yeah, I structure my business as I navigate through this world and not instead of, you know, covering up my identities of how I navigate, like highlighting them, because that's the real world. The real world is not in a room where people, a certain class of people, a group of people are sharing wines and eating oysters. That's right. That's not the real world, but that's the world that we all participate. Still, you know, it, like we participated in and still participate in, and that's still all, you know, that's the pleasure of what we do. But, you know, me getting access to land, like, you know, people like even the haters of me, like or saying I'm an overnight success, like not knowing, I just literally has fought for the same thing you have, to be able to farm and make wine. That's all I wanted. And then along the way, you know, the way I structured my business is to not have people go through the things that I had to navigate going through and changing the culture. You know, we're bringing in five seasonal employees, and they're literally seasonal employees getting paid $20 an hour, volunteering, not, I'm going to give you a place to sleep and eat, and that covers your labor, but your body has been used to harvest grapes that I will make money from. That's undeniable. And, you know, and that my bottle of wine costs $45. You're not paying $45 because I was on the fucking Today Show. It's because I provide health insurance and a livable wage to my employees and time off. And that is that's sustainability. It's beyond farming organically. It's about what truly do you see as equity. I think it's my responsibility. And I made mistakes along the way just as a business owner, as a manager. And, like I said, for all of us to be introspective during this time, it's a pivot we all need to make. What do we mean when we say sustainability, especially within our sector, within the quote unquote natural wine world?
Right. And, you know, you're a woman-owned business. You have an eye towards making sure that, you know, the business is dominated by and with women.
Yes.
Plus all the care towards, you know, your help, the recognition and all of that. That was my point. I mean, if everybody viewed their business, you know, with most of those ideals, I mean, it would be, or most of those actions, it would be a better world. So kudos to you. You brought something. Yeah, well, you're doing well and you're doing better than most, and you know, you'll only be more enlightened and do more better things. So it's good. You mentioned organic and biodynamic. Before we talk about, you know, Zaffa and Co. a little more in detail, I think you're a good person to talk about regenerative and sustainable farming. I need you to just take a second to explain to everyone what it is, and then, you know, how you follow these practices, and maybe someone can explain to me why everyone isn't following these practices. So talk to me, you know, about literally, you know, the fields and the farming.
For Zaffa, when we say that we practice regenerative farming practices with organic and biodynamic philosophies, it's, you know, based and foremost, it starts first and foremost with the soil. And instead of eradication, it's mitigation and utilizing what's around you. Instead of eradicating what's around you, it's mitigating what's around you by utilizing it. And it's observation, reacting, instead of eradicating and before. And so we, you know, we lost 2.5 acres of fruit yesterday.
But this isn't the first time you've had a fruit problem like that. Once was with bugs. Tell about yesterday and just throw in the other story.
Yeah, yesterday, you know, I am trying to figure out a way. We don't use tractor and aisle at all. So the vineyards that we have, that we are currently regenerating, were previously farmed at one point in time conventionally. The Huntington Vineyard that I'm about to talk about had no activity at all, abandoned for 2 years. This is now the second that we've been in it, and the only time we've only had a tractor in it 4 times. So basically just avoiding compaction, we do everything right by feet, even, you know, to mitigate powdery, downy, black rot, we rotate biweekly sulfur and nettle, horsetail tea, and regalia, which is a biofungicide made from knotweed.
Right.
I do not use copper, and we do everything.
Those are all things to fight fungus and bugs and all that, right?
So this year was a hot, you know, was very, very warm here. So we literally had only we rotated those two, 3 times, and we spray by feet, by foot, backpack. Right now, and I'm utilizing the sites that, you know, along the way until I was able to plant my own vineyard, which we just did, you know, a couple of weeks ago. I'm utilizing the sites that we started leasing as a study to see literally how many people, if I continue to not use tractor and aisle, how many people will it take to, you know, to do a biofungicide spray on foot, on using a backpack instead of a tractor. So anyway, and then along with that, like birds. So I, you know, I utilize the Huntington site as a test site to not use netting, do netting, and how can we mitigate birds without putting on nets?
Is netting like an unnatural thing? Like you shouldn't have to net? You want to figure out. Go ahead.
Yeah, the word natural is, you know, trick is it's you know, I'll speak to this. I, you know, times that I, you know, was in Texas, you know, when you have to, you know, lift up the nets when it's time to harvest and you're seeing, you know, there's birds that are dead in there, or you're having through the growing season when you're having to save birds because they get caught in, is not fun and is not something that I actively want to do for the next 20 years. And, you know, and there's other farmers that I've, you know, talked to in ways that they've mitigated birds, even as putting a body, you know, putting a manufactured body of water somewhere inside the vineyard that they're attracted to. All they want is water. They're actually not sitting there eating grapes.
So because of the liquid in the fruits,
exactly. Yeah.
They go to, right.
Yeah. And they know the sugar is there. So then it's liquid.
Right.
So, you know, I use the Huntington site as a way to, it was a 3 acres, which I get to use as a prototype for the 10 acres that we're planting here, as like, how can I use this as a way that when on our own site, you know, what will work and not work.
Right.
That's, you know, we arrived and I walk out with my team. We have our macro bins back of the truck ready to go plant. And I knew that there's, the birds were in there, but you know, we were there on Friday. I checked the bricks and the pH, everything's ready. We called the pick for Monday. We arrived there, called the pick for Tuesday and arrived there and all the fruit was gone besides on in the petite pearl, cause the sugar is not there yet. And, my vineyard and my vineyard manager, he broke down crying and he was still crying. He was, you know, still upset that, you know, he still cried this morning. And, you know, I had to have a talk with him. He's like, I hope I can get to the place where you are, that you're not. And I was like, I made a choice and I have to sit with my choices and the choice not to net. I was like, I could have told you guys to net, you know, 3 weeks ago. And I sit with my choice, and it's
right.
that vineyard is regenerating itself. And, you know, I wasn't, that harvest was not for the yield, you know, and you look out there, you look at the way that vineyard looked 2 years ago and where it looks right now, and it's healthy as fuck. And like, I explained to him, that's what we worked our ass for that year, to get that vineyard healthy again. The fruit, it will come. And this year I didn't, you know, communicate to them. Like that was like, I didn't, not that I didn't care that we lost fruit, but I'm not, you know, that's, I wasn't betting on that fruit. All of our energy is for the health of it. And for, to me, if anything, that's, if that could, any intel of like where my frame of thinking is, you know, the way that I'm farming and truly trying to think regeneratively and, you know, and especially in the context of the soil, I took a chance and the fruit's gone, but the vineyard is healthy as fuck and I could sleep with that.
Right. In the long run.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
You're a saint and you're patient.
Yeah. I need to know what I'm going to do next year though. Like, I'm not going to lie. I have a year to figure that out.
We ain't doing this bird thing every year.
Exactly. Yeah.
Then it'll get crazy.
My team would kill me. Like, they're breaking their backs out there. And I'm just doing experiments. No, I can't. So I have
you have to feel for them.
And that's when I make a decision. I might net next year, but that's just, but those are the things you learn, and that's the beauty and tragedy of farming, you know?
Yeah. Let's talk about Zaffa Wines. You got into it a little, but, you know, we'll get even into more specifics. It doesn't seem like it, but I'm curious. I mean, has the pandemic affected you or the winery, the business in any way? I mean, anybody get sick? Did it affect, you know, selling?
No, we've done quarantining. You know, it from a business perspective, from a fiscal business perspective, it has not affected the business. I'm probably
that's great.
With that. Yeah.
That's great. I don't think Vermont's much of a hotspot either, but you know, either way, it could happen anywhere. So you've talked about this, you know, I want to get a little more specific. You've been leasing land from growers, you know, hundreds of acres. But you talked about, and you know, tighten it up a little about, you purchased a substantial plot to grow your own grapes. What are we talking about? 50 acres or so?
56 acres, and with the aid of the Vermont Land Trust, we closed on 56 acres. It was about a month ago. It's been a blur because we got the keys on a Friday, and then on that Monday we started planting 2003.
Right, wine. Which you had mentioned that. Is that Isle Lamont?
Correct. Yes, that's Isle Lamont.
Okay. Now, when you said Huntington is one of the leased properties?
Yeah, it's about 20-year-old vineyard, one of the oldest vineyards here, which is crazy because Vermont, you know, when you say oldest vineyard somewhere, you're talking about hundreds of years. Here, it's
right.
One of the oldest vineyards is 20-something years old, yeah.
So what do you think the new property, how long is it going to take before you think you could pull grapes off and make wine?
That's a good question one thing COVID did is we were supposed to close on the property in July. No, June, actually. Then it got pushed to July. And then, by the time we went to plant, you know, I consulted with another grower here, with a horticulturist that we got the vines from. And they're like, you know, you're going to plant in August. You could mark it off your list, but you're not going to get anything out of this year. So meaning like pushing us back a year from planting. And
right.
We, because, you know, the climate, we planted on that first planting on that Monday. And then that next day we got torrential rain, a storm came through. I'm not going to lie though. Like, you know, I fought for this property, you know, this property, Isle Lamont sits on the oldest coral reef known at this moment, which is also makes it the most diverse soils. Right. And I chose the site for specifically the soil and then the warming effect because the proximity of the land to the water. But, you know, I'm convincing, you know, talk to the land trust and, you know, their understanding of the soil series is all with annuals and not, you know, their understanding of even with vines in relation to soil. It's still something that we're all learning about here, with these particular cultivars. And so I went, you know, I fought for that soil, you know, blah 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 blah. And I still have imposter syndrome. And I, you know, when we had that rain, I walk out there and I'm like, I walk out there by myself, you know, play it cool with my team, and you know, I'm just basically just hoping, like, you know, I fought for this soil. So I planted on silty loam and sandy loam, and like, if there's puddles of water out there, then I got this all wrong. And you would never even knew that, you know, we got 3 inches the right. day before. And that was
it drained beautifully.
And wow. So with that, and so we,
you nailed it.
It made me cry, honestly. Cause it was like, I exhaled. It was like, I fought for this shit. And, you know, and, you know, it goes back to like, you know, overnight success, but that overnight success doesn't come with, you know, understanding and truly, you know, putting my heart in, you know, researching the soil series and these, and anyway, I digress. But it was something I still like, I had to, it was emotional for me because this is what I've been wanting, what I've been fighting for all this time. And, you know, and then, so we finished the plan. It took us 4 days to do the 2000 something vines, and we consistently would get 80 degrees, you know, peak in the day and then rains. And right now the vines are probably about 6 inches and we're already knocking flowers off of them. So we got this is the first leaf, so we could count this as a vintage. And so I'm like, all the people said that I was, you know, that was not going to work. It's like another way of saying like, look at me now. And so it's, and that's for my team too. And so with that being said, we'll continue, you know, drop fruit. And if anything, we do a harvest, it'll be in 2023. Sorry.
Okay.
So the third year. Yeah. But I want it now to be a full harvest. I wouldn't expect even a full like tonnage out of that until 2024, 2025, but okay. they're really vigorous. So it's hard to tell. And I will say, right. And when we're going to plant more, we're going to plant more next year. And like something, you know, I was even talking to my team about today is that, you know, we're being told we plant in June. And you know, it's what it taught me is that this particular site, maybe the best time to plant is not in June. It's for us, maybe in August, considering the success that we have with this planting.
You may have stumbled on. It's such a learning process, right? Right, I mean, right. You know, if you get forced to do one thing and it may be a benefit. Krista, yeah. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get into, you know, more of Zaffa Wines and a bunch of other things. We're talking to Krista Scruggs from Zaffa Wines and Co-Sellers. You're listening to The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
I'm Lisa Held, a food journalist and podcast host, presenting Behind the Label with American Humane. Produced by Heritage Radio Network for Springer Mountain Farms, this podcast series dives into what the American Humane Certified Label really means. We're looking inside the farm certification process, beginning with the moment a farmer expresses interest in becoming American Humane Certified, all the way to a consumer seeing the seal on store shelves.
And American Humane is our country's first national humane organization, founded way back in 1877. Now we certify nearly 1 billion farm animals each and every year. Despite that growth, roughly 90% of U.S. farm animals are still raised without the benefit of independently verified science-based standards.
Subscribe to Behind the Label with American Humane wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Krista Scruggs. Krista from Zaffa Wines and Co-Sellers in Vermont. Are you going to build a winemaking facility on the new property?
Oh, yeah. So right now, actually, my team is, I think that is right. I can hear them. They're about to start grinding pears and apples right now. So the home is being converted completely to a kitchen tasting room and a winery. So
when you say home, there was a physical building on the property?
Yeah, I'm now currently sitting in what can be considered the den of the physical property. Yeah.
Are you going to live there? Or are you living there? Or
yeah, I'm living here right now. I'll be here through the whole transformation to the winery.
That's cool.
And the tasting room. We have two other structures. We have two barns, larger barns. The larger barn will be for barrel storage and for the lab for the winery. And then the garage is being converted completely to the winery. Downstairs is being converted to the tasting room. And then upstairs will be office and then housing for the staff. And
so then, you had a head start with some of the buildings there.
It's worked out. I couldn't.
Are you going to put housing on the property?
Yes, that's the plan. Cool. Yeah.
You know, we talked about, you know, regenerative and sustainable. You know, now that we're talking about wine, I mean, just talk to me about practices in the cellar. I mean, you know, we're talking natural wine. You know, you try to do everything cyclically, naturally. Just explain what you're doing in the cellar that follows that path.
For example, yesterday we harvested from our Northfield, one of the other vineyards I released in Northfield, harvested La Crescent and Marquette. After we did three quarters of the La Crescent harvest, we actually stomped that out there in the vineyard. And I wanted to get fermentation started out there, and we then
is doing it outside literally, does that make fermentation quicker?
Who knows? I mean,
maybe not.
You know,
okay.
No,
nothing definite.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, that's just, no, like, yeah. But okay. The rest of it, it's whole cluster. And we picked all of Marquette, my whole cluster, brought that back into the cellar, put the, so I'm doing a semi-carbonic. So the juice from the La Crescent will then inoculate, it will inoculate the fermentation for the carbonic fermentation that we're doing in the vessel.
Now explain carbonic fermentation.
In simple terms, it's fermentation starting inside the berry.
Inside the berry itself.
Yes.
Now is the top of the, is it a covered, do you have to cover the top of the
an anaerobic environment.
Tank?
So it needs to be completely closed, sans oxygen.
Right. And it's definitely a style. It's definitely a great style. Definitely a style in favor right now. What, in your description, carbonic maceration does what to the taste, the mouthfeel, the body of a wine?
If anything, at least for me, why with these cultivars we're working for, I wanted to basically lift the fruit. It highlights the fruit, in my opinion.
Right.
Yeah.
You mentioned a few grapes. There's some pretty interesting grapes in Vermont, and I think you've made your name by, you know, making grapes that come from Vermont. You know, these are hybrid grapes. Just, you mentioned a couple. Let's just go through the names of some of the grapes that you've been working with. You mentioned La Crescent. Was that one of them?
I mean,
how many different grapes are you working with?
Well, we just planted alone 7, and one of our sites, there's 11 different.
Really?
These are all.
You said La Crescent was a descendant of what?
Muscat.
Okay.
Marquette is the grandchild of Pinot. So, you know, for those who are listening, with hybrids, French American hybrids, it's a cross between. Horticultural cross between indigenous grapes here, which would be known as like Riparia or Lambrusca, and then crossed with multiple times with different viniferas, what's known as, you know, some is known as Pinot or Cabernet. And it's also not just the Lambrusca and Riparia indigenous, it's multiple indigenous varieties crossed with multiple vinifera varieties until it makes, for example, a Marquette.
But these are grapes that have been crossed for many years, right?
Yes,
I mean,
correct.
You're not necessarily doing that or the grafting. These are the grapes that have sort of been, you know, grown as hybrid grapes through the years or made hybrid grapes, correct?
Right, yeah. The University of Minnesota and Cornell, I think, are the, well, to take all the credit for that, that they've been crossing and crossing and crossing. And it takes years and years and years to cross.
You talked about the new... you know, vineyard that you planted, what did you plant a variety, you know, different rows of different grapes? I mean, how did you plant the new property?
We planted 7 different cultivars and La Crescent.
Okay.
I put that on 3 different, there's working right now, currently 3 different soil series. And I particularly want to see how La Crescent showed itself on 3 different soil series. I did.
Interesting.
I start with Marquette, and then, which is a red grape, and then I went to La Crescent, which is a white grape, and then went to Frontenac, which is a red grape, then went to Itasca, which is a white grape. And I wanted, and I and I split them all up so I could see how they do on the silt and only do on the loam. And so for each varietal, I am going to be able to see how they do respond on the sandier loam of the soil and the siltier loam of the soil, and then La Crescent, I'll see it on all three.
Right.
Yeah. So everything's planted at from north to south. When we were out there doing the rows, I literally was out there with them. My team probably hated me, but I was putting my compass on the ground to make sure that they hit that angle.
It's the only way to tell.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's the only way to tell. But you're the good old fashioned compass.
Exactly.
Now, to that point, because there's a little experimentation, you know, how the grapes are going to react, how you plant them. You're one of these guys that doesn't make the same wines every year. I mean, let's face it, you haven't done, you know, 20 vintages, but,
right.
You know, in the handful you've done, you know, it doesn't reoccur necessarily, except for maybe one or two things. Why is that?
One, you know, I think it started as circumstance, because as someone who didn't have their own land and, you know, hustling to, you know, to farm someone's acre or 3 acres that they didn't no longer want to touch, or sourcing group of fruit from whatever produce a grower that I could get that was, you know, farming in a way that was suitable to my standards. I more or less, you know, I didn't have a choice. And then I realized that what a beautiful place to be, because I'm already, you know, I'm already working with grapes that luckily don't have a standard that I have to live by. And then two, because we're all still in this region learning about these grapes, we're just barely like a, you know, in the context of like comparative vinifera, we're just still a sperm that's swimming around and it has even right. like, and so we, why would I limit myself into one way of making something when we have so much to learn? And, you know, there's even ways that I've done fermentations that I don't have, you know, examples of, and there's ways that, you know, Deirdre set the path for certain ways of doing things, and Ethan has set in the fable, and the beauty is we all get to, you know, figure out exactly how these grapes work for the style I'm trying to make. But I still don't want to be limited within that. I don't want to be limited to what style of make that I want to make, because mostly that vintage should tell me more than me trying to, you know, recreate that, you know, Jungle Fever. And it was the Jungle Fever 2017 that really much, you know, changed the
Jungle Fever is one of your wines. And that's one of the reoccurring wines, right?
Right. The one I just, 2019, I just released, it's the only one I named the same. And only reason I named the same, because to honor the fact that wine, you know, when I poured it and, you know, a Brumaire, that's when the right people tasted it and it put my name out there. So it's an ode to what, you know, many things kicked off my career. But at the back of the 2019 vintage, I put my aim is not to be consistent, and it's a different blend each year. And it's mostly just, I don't want to be limited to try to chase something that, you know, that quote unquote gave me success. So I'm not trying to chase the best of a vintage. I'm just trying to make the best one of that vintage. And what that means, I think that vintage should tell me that, and not me trying to chase quote unquote perfection.
That's exactly it. It's what you're dealt, not, you know, what you could mold it into, you know,
exactly.
The same thing or some, you know, which is great. And I guess you're going through so much new stuff that, you know, it continues to be a learning process.
And it's fun. And, you know, and I think it pushes me and more than anything. And, you know, I am curious about, like, you know, when, you know, four years from now, I will have a state fruit that I, you know, I'm not driving up and down the state, you know, from the sites that we farm. I will have fruit that I intentionally planted, intentionally wanted to see how they did in this style of way. And like, I do wonder, you know, 5 years from now, what does that look like? You know, when I have a state fruit that I will have the same fruit every year. And I just hope my intentions to, you know, through my fermentation style, that I continue to stand by this philosophy that I have. I think, you know, you never know. So we'll listen to this 5 years from now.
It'll be interesting. If I'm still doing this, I'll have you on. You know, but I know this, besides minting grapes, you have a pretty serious focus on apples. True?
True.
How did this come about?
Once again, circumstance. The first was supposed to be my first vintage I had left to go to Texas to work on my project there.
Uh-oh, we lost her. Amanda, you there?
I'm managing.
Oh, yes. There you are.
Yeah, Vinish, I was supposed to be managing. We lost all the foliage to Japanese beetles, which is a common pest in vineyards, particularly out here. And so I was, you know, with the encouragement of Deirdre at the time, was left to what was only fruit that was available here in Vermont that you could just get, you know, at the side of the road or and in someone's backyard orchard, which was apples. And
right.
I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I just fermented it in the way that I, you know, the way I knew at the time how to ferment wine. And, you know, I saw, you know, and tasted, of course, Deirdre and Fable Farm, you know, doing, and even Shaxbury do too, grape skins with wine, fermenting grapes, macerating grape skins on wine juice, the juice itself. And I just, that first in 2017, I was curious about doing a grape must to apple mash co-fermentation, and just I had nothing to lose at that point in time. What I had to lose, like, you know,
and throw it in the pot, right?
Yeah, exactly.
See what happens. Yeah.
intention, but like without like yeah. What the fuck, you know? Like,
yeah.
And
maybe it'll be good.
Yeah, and if not, like I'll be exactly where I started. I didn't lose anything, and
right.
But I gained a lot. And that include, you know, falling in love with apples. And, you know, with this property, there used to be an orchard here, and then there was actually, and then after that, there are cows here, and those cows then, you know, from eating apples, they shed and the seeds spread, and there's, you know, trees that are 20 years old.
Yep.
That seeded themselves. And so now, you know, instead of driving up and down Vermont foraging apples, my team's out there foraging and 30 acres of fallow land of wild fruit right now. And just to, you know, like to bring that to circle and know that I, you know, with the vineyard out there now, and then we have our own wild apples we could forage from and grow from and bring and regenerate. We'll start pruning them next fall. I also planted an acre of apple trees at the Clemens Family Farm, a partnership that I have here in Vermont. So I definitely have an affection towards apples, mostly because they saved me. My career, it changed my career.
That's
and
awesome.
Changed my perspective of fermentation, of limitation that, you know, that what is wine? And it's not limited to this grapes. And that just
right.
Set me on an,
right.
a whole nother path, it seems.
Yeah, I mean that's part of the, you know, the sort of the new American wine revival. It's not just wine. It's fermentation.
Exactly.
All right, I want to try to get to our weekly wine list because I'd love to get your take on a few things you're drinking. But before we get to that, I have one more question, and I've been doing the show. This will be our fourth year. And one of the things that I've learned and I've morphed towards is natural wines, understanding them, consuming them, talking to people, knowing a lot, you know, more about it. But it's very polarizing. And even the term natural wine, you know, which you use freely and you have every, you know, you have all the cred to do that. But, you know, how do you define it? I mean, I guess we talked about it, you know, how you farm and how you cellar, right? I mean, is it still fair to call it natural wine as long as you walk the walk?
You know, if I'm being frank, I think the natural wine community and, I just hope that with everything's happening in the world and like, and I hope like some self-reflection, like I just hope that people actually just move away from even defining that and just like defining how are you showing up as a human being and choose
right.
to say
it applies almost anything.
Exactly.
Natural wine, like, natural people.
Exactly. And so like, I just like, if you're going to like rock that word and like fucking rock it all the way and like think about actually like, how are you from like your teammates, your employees, your individuals in this community, our colleagues, like there's so much drama in this industry. And it's like, and then like, it's just, if we just focus on actually like the naturally just treating each other like good and well, and then that to me, that were to hold more weight. And I don't know if I'm even answering the question right.
No, it's very well said, because the answer is deeper than, you know, just low intervention or no pesticides. You kind of hit it on the nose. It's very organic beyond, you know, organic farming.
Yeah, I would rather, like, there's someone who's farming, if someone's putting 100 ppm to sulfur in their wine, and, you know, farming IPM, and they're paying an equitable wage to their employees and take care of the people around them, I would rather support that person than someone who's saying that, you know, right, wearing this badge of quote unquote natural wine and doing the exact opposite of how they're treating the people around them and their employees.
I agree. All right, we have maybe 7-8 minutes left. I want to do the wine list. I'm going to ask you 5 questions. I ask the same 5 questions to every guest. We've asked over 200 people these 5 questions. We post them on social media. People, after listening to Krista, they will love knowing what Krista's drinking. Don't dwell on these answers. You know, just buzz through them. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? You know, what's in the fridge? What are you trying? What's seasonal? You know, what's a thing to you now?
Oh, I just like threw away a bottle. What did we just have the other? Oh, what a question.
That specific. It doesn't have to be that one bottle, but you know, is it beer? Is it cider? You know, what are you drinking now?
Beer. I'm beer. And mostly because I'm just trying to repair my relationship with beer. Beer. I've been drinking a lot of beer lately.
Is it cheap Bud Light, or you take advantage of the fact that Vermont's a great, you know, craft brewery?
I have a Focal Banger right now, the Alchemist right in front of me, but there's some Coors inside the drawer right now too, if I'm being honest.
Alchemist are the guys that make Heady Topper, right?
Yes.
So they're pretty happening. All right, so you're drinking beer now. It's a good thing to drink during the harvest. All right, second question, goofiest of the bunch. Do you have, maybe it goes back to a kid or, you know, a few years, do you have a favorite wine and food pairing?
Oh, pizza.
Is there something?
Everyone knows I love pizza. So pizza and
what's the perfect alcoholic drink with pizza?
Wine.
But what?
Oh.
Don't be so general. What? Lambrusco? Champagne? Yeah. Give me something.
I actually like a good Beaujolais with pizza.
Okay, yeah. That I think I take. Do you have any faves on the Beaujolais front?
No, I don't want to answer that. I hate having I do, but I don't. Yeah.
Okay. That's, you know, I have trouble asking that question sometimes.
Yeah.
And maybe this one will even fall into that. Do you... Because I don't want you to be exclusive, but do you have a favorite wine restaurant and or bar, you know, a place where they have the selection, they have the service, they have the knowledge, they have the vibe? Is there anything up there, you know, when you come?
Daedalus Wine. Like they're truly my family here. They, Daedalus
D-E-D,
Wine.
D-E-D.
D-E-D-A-L-U-S.
Okay, Daedalus Wine, and that's in Burlington.
Yeah, we're right down the street from Co-Sellers. Yeah,
from Co-Sellers. Yeah, I've heard of them. It's nice to hear that, and we'll give them a shout out. Fourth question: we ask people their favorite all-time wine. Now, let me go backwards on this. When I structured the question was really to incite people to tell me about the most expensive and rare wine they ever had, you know, because I have Psalms on the show and winemakers. But it morphed into something more important, which is, what's a wine, you know, throughout your life or your career or whatever that was important or life-changing or continues to resonate with you? You have one?
You know, like, I think, and it's interesting. So, like, I would just say, like, literally anything, like, it would change my life. Why I'm doing what I'm doing is because I'm from California. And, like, and for me, and I probably someone would be surprised to say this, but, like, when I see a Robert Mondavi bottle, it, like, it just brings me back to, like, that's, like, that was on my table growing up as a kid.
Right.
And
so that
California, and, like, you know, like, there's not going to be one particular bottle, but just it's that Robert W. means something to me in a way as a California native, and, you know, growing, you know, even though he was not, you know, Constancy Brands ended up buying like the private selection.
Right.
When I started working with Constancy Brands, that was a huge deal for me I was being a part of something that was something so embedded in me, you know, that didn't grow up with anyone in the wine industry, but I grew up in the middle of wine culture, rather, you know,
so economically. The answer to that is very clear to me. It's more about the wine that was around that you remember that had an impact. You know, who was bigger than Mondavi in those days? It was ubiquitous.
Right.
You know, so that's an important wine to you. I totally
right.
get that.
Right.
All right, last question. Can you recommend best wine around $15-$20 retail, a red and a white? Through your travels, you know, my kids are in their 20s. They can't go and bring supermarket wines to parties or dinners, but they can't spend, you know, $40. What do you think are good value wines? A red and a white. And you can be category, like Muscadet is, you know, a great white. But in your mind, tell me a good value red and a good value white. Can you think of that?
Oh, that's a good, so it doesn't have to be, it could be stylistically, but not like.
Yeah, it could be anything.
You know, I still, honestly, you could, you know, you could get a Pet Nat, and, you know, I personally am not drinking Pet Nats left and right, but I think that.
You know, Pet Nat's a great value, right?
Yeah, it's a good value.
It's a sparkler. It exactly. could be white or it with color.
It serves its purpose, I think. And, you know, there's.
That's see, yeah. You gotta answer the question. You got another idea like that?
No, I think that's I'll stick
it
with
it goes
that.
Both ways. I'm gonna yeah, take
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Good job on that. And like I said, that was the whole point, not to be nervous. Like I said, we're gonna post it on our social media sites, you know, within the next week. Krista, we gotta wrap up. That's an hour. I told you it'd go fast. Let me do a quick wrap up, and then I want to get some info from you. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at SBenRuby. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby. But you can always use the hashtag The Grape Nation to get to us on both. Like I said, we'll post Krista's wine list on our social media sites. Krista, this is important. Your wines are very sought after. You're not a big production guy. But if people want to know more about your wines, your story, and where even to try to get them, where can we find more about Zaffa and Co., and where can we find you on social media?
For more information about the wines and actually to get first dibs, it's go to zaffawines.com and sign up for the newsletter. I really do honor that. We do drop wines first and foremost to our newsletter subscribers and people who are in our wine club. And then following me on...
The wine club is Counterspellers?
Correct. Yeah, Counterspell.
Okay.
Yeah.
Counterspell.
Correct. And we're actually going to open more seats to that soon because we realize there's a high demand for that. And it keeps us also to have a more personal relationship with the people who want my wines, our wine. So,
nice.
Yeah, staying like zaffawines.com and sign up for newsletter. Like we really do. We take care of you guys there. And then
okay.
follow me on Instagram, me and my team. And Zaffa is not just me. I have 7 people that make this all happen that should get more credit than I do sometimes. So,
well, you're rarely in a lot of the posts.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You throw it around to your guys a lot, which is nice. So that's at Zaffa Wines.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So we got the website. We got the Instagram. If anybody wants to stay on top, and you can go to Google and Google Krista Scruggs Today Show, and you could see her appearance on the Today Show a couple of weeks ago. That was interesting. All right, Krista, we got to go. I want to thank our guest, Krista Scruggs. From Zaffa Wines and Co. Sellers. I love what you're doing.
Thank you.
So good luck, continued luck. Promise me one thing, and this is a promise that has to be a promise.
What's the promise?
I will be coming up to Vermont sometime in the next year or two when the life gets to normal. You'll show me around and let me taste a couple of things?
It would be, I would love.
Okay.
To, yes, please.
All right.
Please.
I'm going to come to you
yes,
with.
Please. Yes, please. I would okay. love that. Yes.
I wish it could be like next weekend
too,
or when harvest is over, but the world is so screwed up.
I was going to say that. Yeah.
So thank you to Krista. Thank you to, as always, our engineer, Amanda, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. And one last shout out. I want to thank Eric Benny Bloom and Ryan Zoidis from the band Lettuce. They composed the new Grape Nation theme song. So, Krista, you are the first show with my new proprietary theme song.
And Eric has been supportive of me, too.
Yes, yeah, Eric opened a distributorship in Colorado.
Yeah, good guys. I some wine.
Yeah, I'm sure you'd love to have your stuff if there is any.
Yeah,
all right, Krista, got to say goodbye. Thanks again. I'm Sam Van Rubin. You've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.